Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, from the ashes of a harsh recession, can a new set of sustainable ownership models emerge? And then on the Scholar Circle, new leaked memos reveal some inner workings of the Supreme Court's decision-making. What's truly behind judicial decisions, and what are the real impacts on American society? Sometimes disasters bring something new and better, says our next guest, and that could very well be the situation with our economic system now. In fact, all over the world, people are joining together in efforts to find new ownership models that can sustain people and communities. New generative models for housing, employment, and credit aim to sustain life for generations to come. The new book, Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, says they are forming a movement that may not yet know it's a movement. With us now is Marjorie Kelly. She is a fellow at the TELUS Institute think tank and the author of The Divine Right of Capital and her latest book, Owning Our Future. She was also the founder of Business Ethics Magazine. Well, welcome back, Marjorie Kelly.
It's fun to be here. Thanks for having me,
it's
Maria.
It's great to have you back on the air with us with your brand new book. What I'd like to start with is really this idea that crisis often can bring something unexpectedly good, and that here we're in an economic crisis as well as an environmental one, but the economic crisis may actually allow for some kind of transformation. So let's start with this idea. What gives you hope that this may occur? That you actually gave an example of an organization in Great Britain that occurred from the ashes like that.
You know, Maria, I look even at a very simple level. We have a couple of trees that we lost in our yard a few years back. We mourned these trees. We thought, what can we replace these with? And then there was a small magnolia tree beneath one of them that just shot up and filled out that space. And I realized it hadn't had room to grow yet. And this is something that happens ecologically. When you have what looks like a crisis, it can kind of clear the way for new species to shoot up. And I think that's what we can see. You know, as we're seeing the big banks in crisis, I think we can start to see alternative kinds of ownership having their day.
And this one example that you wrote about in the book, it was in a different section, but about a giant employee-owned company that started because people couldn't afford to eat. What was this company and what happened?
That's a really fascinating example. This is the Rochdale Pioneers. It was back in the 1800s, and it was when the Industrial Revolution was just beginning. And there were craftsmen who were pushed out of their jobs and couldn't afford to eat. And so they formed the world's very first cooperative. It was a store. They were selling food to people who couldn't afford to buy it. You became a member and you could buy food at the store. And it was the world's first cooperative. And that is now a model that has spread to most nations. There are millions of members of cooperatives all over the world. In fact, cooperatives now employ more people than all multinationals combined. This is not very widely known.
You mean globally?
I mean globally, that's right. And just in brief, a cooperative is a business that is owned and controlled democratically by the people it serves. It could be employees, it could be customers, it's in a credit union. There's a number of different forms.
We have, on this show, talked quite a bit with the people of Mondragon and about that model spreading around. But aside from Mondragon, we don't know very many.
You know, there are a surprising number. You know, in fact, cooperative banks are very common in Europe. The Rabobank in the Netherlands, it's the largest bank, I believe, in the entire country. And across Europe, cooperative banks control 21% of all deposits. And so this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, is that as widespread and large as these alternative ownership models are, they remain largely invisible. And I think it's because we haven't named them yet. And so I try to name them in the book. I say it's really the generative economy. These are designs that are not aimed at creating maximum amounts of short-term capital. They're aimed at creating the conditions for life. They want to generate the conditions for life.
Well, that leads us right to the kind of crux of your argument. One is really about ownership being at the root of economic systems. But the second one is that you identify two different kinds of ownership models, one that is more generative and one that is what you call extractive.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we first talk about the extractive model, because it's kind of the one that you identify as the problem.
Yeah, that's right. I think that many of us, unconsciously, we think of ownership as a fact. You own something or you don't. But really, it's a design. It has a design. And the design that we know most pervasively is corporations. So they have a particular ownership design where their ownership shares trade in public stock markets. And the purpose of these companies in this kind of ownership is to extract as much financial wealth as possible. So we believe that stock portfolios should go up every quarter and that shareholders should have the right to maximize their returns. It's really an industrial age model. And it's pervasive. I mean, it really is the largest, most pervasive model in the world. And then when I say, but, you know, there's another way to own things, and that's generative. It's where you're owning things with the purpose of serving life, serving the community. And I point, for example, to a large employee-owned firm in the UK that has the largest department store chain in the UK. It's John Lewis Partnership. It's 100% owned by its employees. And its purpose, they state publicly, is to serve employee happiness. And it's an example of a company that's large and successful and out there operating like a regular business, and it has a different purpose. It's not about extracting wealth for shareholders. It's about making employees happy.
And this extractive model, of course, can be taken to seen in terms of other things that are extracted as well, like natural resources as opposed to generative serving.
Right. Yeah, and so the point that I'm trying to make is that there's really two kinds of extraction in this industrial age economy. There's physical extraction, which we know so well. You know, you're extracting fossil fuels from the earth. You're extracting, you know, all kinds of physical elements from the earth. But then there's also this financial extraction, which is really where the action is. You know, if we talk about ecological damage, that's really kind of an effect of the system's action, but its real purpose is the extraction of financial wealth. And that's what we need to start talking about.
So let's talk about what some of the design problems are in this. Like the extraction model, you point to one issue, which is what its purpose is, right? And that's part of the design of it. This is something that people don't talk about very much when they look at a societal or a political problem. They don't look at the system design and the design flaws, thinking that people function as a result of the design. Let's look at these design flaws, one of them being the mission or the purpose.
You know, it's interesting, Maria, because I think a lot of people think, you know, CEOs are the problem. And if we just had a better crop of CEOs, everything would be different. We're not used to thinking about the fact that organization design shapes behavior, that these CEOs are hired by boards to do a particular thing, which is to maximize returns for shareholders. They're paid accordingly. And if they don't do it, they're fired. And so it's a system that's really controlling them rather than vice versa, even though they look like they're at the helm. And so what is really driving these organizations? Well, it's the purpose at their core. You know, if you look at systems thinking, which is a kind of thinking that applies to biological systems and social systems also, you know, it says that what really shapes human communities, human social systems, is values. You know, there are values at the core of particular social architectures. I mean, the court system is a social architecture, and at its core is the value of justice. And, you know, democracy is a social architecture, and at its core is equality and liberty and all the things that democracy stands for. Well, at the core of the social architectures that we have in our economy, these extractive designs, there's this purpose of maximizing financial wealth, and it's for individuals, and not for the community as a whole. So these are really the values at the core of it. And what I'm seeing in the book is that you can have other values that are also embedded in social architectures. I mean, John Lewis Partnership is a key example. You know, they have employee well-being as a key value at the center of it, or cooperatives, which have a value of, you know, the common good. at the center of it. And you can really design ownership architectures, economic architectures, around these values, and it works.
One of the things that you note is that in this particular system's ownership and this design and the mess that they've made, that we're really kind of all tangled up in it. How would you express this entanglement?
No, that's a really key point, Maria. I mean, it's not really about pointing the fingers at bad people somewhere, that they're the problem. It's really about this system design that we're tangled up in. Many of us have stock in our retirement portfolios, and we want to see it do well. Or we work for nonprofits that rely on grant income that comes from financial portfolios. Or maybe we are involved in a foundation, or we support foundations or nonprofits that...
And public employee systems as well.
Yeah, our pensions, right, our pensions and churches. You know, we all are reliant on returns from wealth and donations from wealth. And so it's not an easy thing to step away from it or to just say, you know, let's get rid of this and start something else. You have to really, I think, look for the alternative models that are working in the system as it is and look at how to grow those. So that's a lot what I'm looking at here.
Well, let's take a look at what these alternative models could look like and what some of them are that are emerging. There was a quote you had in your book that even called it, I thought this was great, a movement that doesn't know it's a movement. And that's in part because they're really emerging in disparate places in the world and not necessarily connected with one another. There are several areas that it seems to be working. One is in housing. How do you see the housing model and the ownership model of housing potentially evolving?
You know, that's an interesting story because it was in December 2008 when the stock market was in the middle of this huge crash. It was going down by about 43% in that year. And right in the middle of that, I took a bus to the Community Land Trust Conference here in Boston. And community land trusts are ownership designs where the community will own the land beneath a group of homes through a nonprofit. And then the individual families own their own homes privately. And this model, it reduces the price of homes because it's just the price of a house, not the land, and it stabilizes it. And what I found at that moment when the economy was falling apart was that community land trust homes had a foreclosure rate one-tenth that of traditional homes. And so you didn't see these shenanigans, you didn't see these spikes in prices and then this big collapse in price. You saw a very stable, affordable price. You saw people get to stay in their homes. And that was a result of ownership model and ownership design. I mean, these homes had mortgages, but they were in a different ownership design that was aimed at their well-being. It was not aimed at enriching some banker.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, and I'm Maria Armudian. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, and I'm Maria Armudian. We've been speaking with Marjorie Kelly about her new book called Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution. You focus a lot on the issue of ownership in this particular book. Why is it you settled on ownership specifically?
Well, you know, Maria, you were part of an initiative that we did, which is called Corporation 2020, where for a number of years here at Telus Institute, we brought together leaders and thinkers from business and labor, civil society, finance, government, law, and we explored this question of how would you design companies differently. And I remember one moment, there's a lot of wandering around and seemingly impenetrable kind of concepts. You know, and there was one moment somebody said something that just stopped the whole group. They said, ownership is the original system condition. It's only when things are owned that wealth is created. It is the system condition that allows everything else to happen. When I saw that, I realized that really is true. I mean, ownership is, when you go back really to the agricultural age, back past the industrial age, you see that when we emerged from hunter-gatherer societies and began to take up the settled life of agriculture, that was a physical technology. But you also needed a social technology that allowed that to happen, a social architecture, and that was ownership. I mean, if you don't own the land, you can't farm it if you're going to be pushed off that land. In fact, in many developing countries today, they don't have stable ownership. They don't have good land records or not clear title to land, and so people can't develop that land. They can't start businesses if there isn't clear title or clear ownership. So ownership is really what is the original condition that allows wealth to happen. And it's the foundation of our economy. You know, we don't recognize that, but it is the key condition, the foundation that shapes.
And so what you're arguing now is that it's an ownership problem that is creating the economic crisis, and there's not a shared ownership that is, shall we say, contributing to the things that we really care about, community, mm-hmm. neighborhoods, environments.
I think we need to start from the premise that we can't keep tinkering at the edges of the economy that we have. I mean, we have operated since, you know, for many decades with the premise that the economy is pretty much run by corporations, and then we're just going to regulate them. That's the basic frame that we're in. And if you see that this is beginning to break down, that this is less and less effective, then you need to begin to move toward an economy that is designed differently. It's designed so that accountability is built in. You know, there's a large question about how do you get there, and you can't really start there. You have to start with, well, what is it? I mean, can we even begin to imagine a different kind of economy? I think many people cannot. We just think the economy is what it is. It will always be this way. And so to begin to develop a vision of a different, fundamentally different kind of economy where beneficial outcomes are part of its design, that's the vision that I'm looking for in the journeys of this book and that I'm finding all over the world.
Well, you identified five, actually, core elements, what you call them, of a generative ownership design.
It really starts with purpose. What is the purpose of an entity? Does it have a financial purpose of just maximum financial wealth, or does it have a living purpose? Are we trying to help people stay in their homes? Are we trying to, you know, create jobs and so forth? So living purpose, that is really the first element of generative ownership design. Then next comes membership. And it's what we traditionally call ownership. I call it membership to distinguish it. But, you know, who is the firm? When you draw a circle and say these people are inside the organization, you know, they have a seat on the board, or, you know, they own it. Who are those people? In a cooperative, you can create employee ownership. You draw the circle around employees. In a credit union, you can create a depositor ownership. So you can draw that ownership circle differently. So that with a generative design, you have ownership in human hands. That's a characteristic. Third is governance. Who runs it? Who has a vote for the seat on the board? How do they get there? You can have governance on autopilot, or you can have governance in the hands of mission. So people oriented toward mission, are they the ones who are in control of the organization? So that's third. And then fourth, you have capital. How do you get finance? How do you get capital into these organizations? Do you have, you know, casino finance, which we have now, where shares can trade hands literally tens of thousands of times in a second? Or do you have, you know, it's to finance a friend. So you have stakeholder finance. That's another element of generative ownership design. And then the fifth one is networks. Right now, companies will trade in commodity networks. Well, basically, they'll buy and sell anything if it makes a profit. But generative ownership is about ethical networks that support ethical values. It might be fair trade, it might be organic food, it might be social investing. There's various networks that support ethical values in business.
Okay, and so if you had, say, a bunch of firms that adhered to this, how do we turn that into an economy?
You know, that's a big question, and I think that it's a question that is really as large as the question of global warming. It's about transitioning to a fundamentally different kind of economy. So it's not going to have a simple or a single answer. I mean, you know, with global warming, there are theorists who hypothesize that you need what they call seven wedges. You know, if you're going to reduce carbon use by this dramatic amount, you're going to do it with different wedges of activity. One might be, you know, wind power. Another one might be solar power and so forth. Another one might be, you know, saving energy. So, you know, what are the different wedges that can get us to a different kind of economy? Well, this hasn't been totally worked out. It's not like, you know, one person can step forward with some magic blueprint and make it all happen. But I'll give just a couple of examples. I mean, I think that, first of all, we start with what economists call the rule of 15, that the economy is, you know, if you see GDP rising a couple of percent from year to year, it looks fairly stable, but underneath that there's tremendous churn. 15% of every jobs are being destroyed every year, and 15% are being created. So there's this tremendous churn of both jobs and of companies. And if we could get emerging companies into generative designs, into employee ownership, or cooperative, or, you know, social enterprise, that then you begin to see a very different economy. Maybe you get 10% within 10 years. Maybe in 20 years it's 20%, and so on. So there's kind of an emergent, I think, quality to this. That's one. That could be one wedge. I think another wedge could be, let's look at crisis and the opportunities that offers. For example, when General Motors almost went bankrupt a number of years ago, it suddenly was held by government. Government had to take over General Motors. Well, that was an opportunity. We could have rechartered that firm. We could have said, okay, you are moving forward with a new charter, with the common good is at your core. You're no longer going to be a profit-maximizing company. We could have done the same thing with the big banks. So you can look to crisis. Those are just two examples, I think, of the kind of disparate effort that together can start to build a new kind of generative economy.
I know you have engaged a lot of leaders from the labor union community.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of reactions are you getting from them about changing their model?
Right. You know, Maria, there's actually a really interesting movement happening right now for union cooperatives. And so this is a model that the Teamsters are working for. Mondragon, which is a large cooperative business in Spain, is working for this. And it's the idea that unions themselves would help to create worker-owned businesses and also have unions within them. So the workers can be owners, and yet you would also have collective bargaining. Because just because employees have a few shares doesn't mean they're necessarily in a position to bargain effectively for wages. So there's actually a pretty big movement about that lets these things can work together. So I don't think there's any lack of compatibility between the different approaches.
I wanted to check with you on Latin America. You mentioned it. You mentioned something that you saw there emerging that you called a solidarity economy.
Yeah.
How big is it comparatively to, say, big corporate economies?
You know, that's a key question that I don't think anyone has answered yet. I think it's a very big research question that I'd love to see someone take on. The solidarity economy is a concept that it's in Latin America. It's also in Quebec. It encompasses, in Quebec, it's cooperatives and nonprofits. In Latin America, it's used to refer to a lot of worker-owned businesses as well. So it's the idea that, you know, we're in this together. We're in solidarity. And, I think it's emerging. I think it's growing. But I haven't seen anybody who's yet quantified it.
Finally, we have listeners all over the country. Some of them are out of work, wondering what they can do next. How would you advise them?
People will often say, what can we do to help advance, you know, the ownership revolution, the generative economy? I think there are a number of things we can do. I think that one thing we can do is read. We need to educate ourselves. When we when we lack economic literacy, we become sitting ducks for other people to take advantage of us. And so I think reading about the new economy, you know, reading my book, Owning Our Future, reading other books about progressive economics and these things, this is so vital. I cannot say how vital this is, because we don't have enough knowledge about finance and economics among ordinary people, and we need to. So that's one thing. Another thing is that all of us have bank accounts. And so, I mean, no matter how broke we are, most of us have a bank account. You know, we ought to move our money to cooperative banks and credit unions and locally owned community banks. And I think this is noticed by the big banks.
There was a movement on that for a bit.
Yeah, it's called Move Your Money.
Right.
And I think there's still a website devoted to that. I think that's tremendously powerful. And I think that, you know, perhaps we need to be forming a new economy group. Because I think the other thing, I think the final thing I would say is, this is not something we can solve alone. You know, we can't just go home and buy organic products or, you know, that. It's not a consumer revolution. It's about moving toward a fundamentally different kind of economy, and we need to do that collectively.
So essentially what you're saying is gather up your friends and have this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and one of the things I would say is July 17th through 19th, there's a film coming out called Fixing Our Future, which is talking about the new economy. And, you know, so we ought to go to those kinds of things and form new economy groups. I mean, we need to find ways to act collectively to advance our knowledge and our action. And that's we are not cohering yet as a new economy movement, and we need to.
Marjorie Kelly, the new book is called Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, Journeys to a Generative Economy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, what drives judicial decisions and how do they affect American society? Stay tuned.
Hey, say, I wanna own it, wanna own it, I wanna own it, wanna own it, I wanna own it, wanna own it, I wanna own it, wanna own it. I wanna own it, that's the way I'm on it, the way I'm on it, that's the way I'm on it, I wanna own it, that's the way I'm on it, I wanna own it. This is your chance to own it.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Earlier in the week, someone leaked a high-level memorandum that revealed some of the inner workings of the Supreme Court. The memo suggested that Justice Kennedy had relentlessly pressured Chief Justice John Roberts to vote with the conservative bloc and strike down President Obama's signature health care legislation. It also revealed evidence of non-legal influences on the voting decisions of the Supreme Court. What does drive judicial decision-making? What constrains it? And how do these votes affect American society? We are joined by three experts. Erwin Chemerinsky is Dean and Professor of Law at University of California, Irvine. He has authored several books, including the latest, The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. We also have with us Adam Winkler. He is a professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms. We also have with us Lawrence Baum. He is professor of political science at Ohio State University. His books include The Puzzle of Judicial Behavior, Judges and Their Audiences, and Specializing the Courts. Let's start with putting this into the context of the history of the court. Erwin Chemerinsky, you've suggested this is the most conservative court in modern history. Is this term conforming to your analysis? And if so, how?
Overall, this is a very conservative court. About 75% of the time when the court's ideologically divided, Justice Kennedy joins with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia, Thomas, and Alito to come to a conservative outcome. This term had some notable exceptions to that. Chief Justice Roberts joined with the four liberals to uphold the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, joined with three of the liberal justices, to strike down most of Arizona's SB 1070. The court struck down a statute that restricted freedom of speech, the federal Stolen Valor Act. On the other hand, it would be a mistake to focus just on those cases. This term was terrible for civil rights plaintiffs, continuing a trend of the Supreme Court restricting access to the courts. And I think we're going to see next term again a very conservative court, at least when the court considers whether or not to continue to allow public colleges, universities to use race as a factor in admissions decisions to benefit minorities. It's always dangerous to generalize from one or a few data points. So it's very difficult to generalize from just last week's cases, but what the Roberts Court has been over its whole 7 years.
Adam Winkler.
Well, the Roberts Court is anything but conservative, if by that we mean cautious and hesitant to change. This is a court that, despite a few important rulings this past week that reflected a sense of judicial minimalism, the court has been very activist in the past. Let's not forget this is the court that gave us Citizens United, a court that has pretty much declared war on affirmative action, and next term looks set to strike down affirmative action at the University of Texas. There were a lot of bold, aggressive rulings this term, as well as the moderate, compromising decision of the health care case. So this is not your usual conservative court. One thing I think we see from this past term is really the emergence of the Roberts Court. I think for years we've called this Anthony Kennedy's court because he's the swing justice in most cases, and he still is the swing justice in most cases. However, I think this year marked the birth of what historians will look back on and call the Roberts Court in the same way we think of the Warren Court or the Marshall Court. Because John Roberts was the one who was the swing voter in the Obamacare case. And I think in historical terms, that case really is going to be one of the cases that we talk about for another century, about where the court is at the precipice of perhaps turning back a president's signature legislative accomplishment, something the Supreme Court hasn't done in 75 years. And the court stepped back and preserved its legitimacy in a move that I think will receive the kudos from historians for years to come.
Before we move to Lawrence Baum, you used the word conservative a little bit differently than Professor Chemerinsky. I think we should, for the sake of our audiences, clarify what we mean. Professor Chemerinsky, I think you were speaking of ideological conservatism, whereas I think Professor Winkler, you're talking about judicial activism.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think Erwin and I agree on it completely, that the conservative, this judicial activism that goes in an ideologically conservative way, but the court itself is not a conservative court by the traditional understanding of one that's really a big believer in judicial restraint and judicial minimalism, although we did see that in the healthcare case this year, and that will be an important case in the history of the Roberts Court.
And we should talk about that in just a little bit. First, Lawrence Baum, let's bring you in. How do you see this over the long political trajectory?
Well, I think not only is it difficult to make sense of a small number of decisions in a given term, I think it's often very difficult to make sense of a whole term because the appearance of the court in terms of liberalism and conservatism or activism versus restraint is going to depend a good deal on the particular mix of cases that the court hears in a given term. And so those of us who are looking at the end of a term often are deceived in the short run because we're focusing on patterns that may be somewhat ephemeral. But I think it is the case that the conservative justices on the current court, who do more often than not hold the balance, have been feeling their way, and particularly that is true, I think, of Chief Justice Roberts. And what we might find in the future is that they feel more of a mission. They come down on the side of certain kinds of goals they're trying to accomplish that may not have been evident up to this point. I think there's some reason to think that Chief Justice Roberts, in particular, is gradually gaining a clearer sense of what he'd like to accomplish. And for that reason, among others, we may find ourselves surprised what happens in the terms that come. He's going to be Chief Justice, presumably, for a good long time.
Professor Baum, what kinds of goals do you think those could be?
Well, I think that Chief Justice Roberts, like the other conservative members of the court, feels that legal policy became too liberal in a number of respects, feels that the court decided a variety of issues wrongly and that it would be desirable to address that. It might be, for instance, if that turns out to be true of affirmative action and admissions to public universities, where Chief Justice Roberts, in all likelihood, does feel that the court was too willing to accept it in the past, and that it's time now for the court to take a more definitive stand against affirmative action than it's done up to this point.
Let's look into some of these more recent cases that have been coming down the pike. I think, Adam Winkler, you wrote about the Arizona law. What I'd like to do is kind of look at these cases in their larger context and see where we're heading as a country. Why don't we start with this direction with immigration? Adam Winkler?
Well, we've seen over the last few years a real push by states to gain more control over the immigration process, especially when it comes to illegal aliens. For undocumented workers, we've seen a rash of new laws being passed in state after state trying to make life miserable for illegal immigrants. The Supreme Court in the Arizona case this year made it clear that only the federal government has the constitutional authority to make life miserable for illegal aliens. It wasn't a surprising decision, except for the fact that oral argument had gone poorly for the Solicitor General. In fact, the Supreme Court has a long tradition of upholding federal efforts to stop states from interfering or even trying to help out with immigration law against the wishes of the federal government. And what was particularly interesting about that case, if you think about the direction of the court, was something that happened outside of the case, that happened with Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion in that case and his announcement of it in the courthouse when the opinion was released. And he made very public criticisms of President Obama's current immigration policy, something very unusual for a justice to talk about some current affair, current event, and really even mocked the president for the reasons why he was saying that we needed immigration reform, that it was the right thing to do, he even quoted in sort of very sarcastic language. So that was a really surprising outcome and may show the frustration of Justice Scalia on the court, because after 30 years, he still hasn't had the influence that many people predicted he would have.
I believe it was one of your pieces that talked about how justices normally show deference to the president, and that we're seeing a bit less of that with this particular court and this particular president. Would you say that's the case?
Well, there were some numbers from this term that were pretty interesting. I think we'd have to see how they pan out over future terms to really get a great sense. But this term, the Solicitor General did not have great success in the Supreme Court, at least if you look at the numbers. Obviously, the Solicitor General won some cases and won some very big cases, including the Arizona immigration case and the Obamacare case. However, usually the Solicitor General can count on winning about 70% of the cases to which he is a party. And this year, the Solicitor General only won 45% of the cases to which he was a party. So we're seeing at least a slight decrease in the respect that perhaps that the Solicitor General is making. Perhaps it's just an anomaly of this particular term that the arguments of the Solicitor General weren't widely accepted. But even people who were at oral argument frequently said that it seemed like the Solicitor General was getting a much harder time from the justices than usual. So that's something to keep our eyes out for in the future.
Erwin Chemerinsky.
Well, first, I think the statistic that Adam points to can be explained at least partially by the fact you have a Democratic administration, and therefore a Solicitor General representing a Democratic administration, in front of an overall quite conservative court. So it's not surprising that the Democratic administration is faring less well than, say, a Republican administration would. I also want to echo something else that Adam said. I think that the Arizona case was a resounding defeat for states like Arizona that are trying to adopt their own immigration policy and aggressively enforce against those who are not lawfully in the United States. I was stunned to see newspaper headlines presenting the Supreme Court's decision as either mixed or a victory for Arizona. The Supreme Court upheld a preliminary injunction as to three of the four provisions in the Arizona law, and even to the fourth, the Supreme Court greatly narrowed it and took away any ability of the state to enforce it. This really was a clear message from the Supreme Court to the states that immigration is the responsibility of the federal government. Anything done with regard to immigration affects foreign policy. States can't have their own foreign policies. So I think laws like Arizona's, Utah's, Georgia, South Carolina, Indiana, Alabama are all clearly almost entirely unconstitutional.
Lawrence Baum, you have two lines of thought here that are going on. One has to do with the states here, but also this issue of respecting the other branches. And these are all things that you have looked at as well. How do you see this?
Well, I think that it might be useful to think about what has been happening in the court lately in a broader context. Clearly, politics at the elite level, at least, in the federal government, has become more polarized along partisan lines than it has been in a very long time. And you have, either coincidentally or I think as a result of that polarization, a Supreme Court in which the ideological lines now coincide with partisan lines. And that seems like a natural situation, but it's essentially unprecedented. The polarization that's going on in the political system as a whole inevitably affects the justices. Perhaps not voluntarily, perhaps not consciously, but it's going to affect their thinking. And that doesn't mean they're going to be at loggerheads with each other in the same way that Democrats and Republicans are in Congress, for instance. The court is a very different kind of institution. But when the court addresses cases that are caught up in the political turmoil in the other branches, whether it's the health care case or the immigration case, either consciously or unconsciously, that polarization is going to affect their thinking. And it may be responsible in part for phenomena like that kind of outburst that Justice Scalia made in the immigration case.
Derwin Chemerinsky.
I would agree with that. I think that this is an unusual situation. And what you have is the five Republican justices, just appointed by Republican presidents, four appointed by Democratic presidents. And I don't think it's said enough that the Supreme Court justices are fairly far to the right. These aren't moderate Republicans. I mean, if you look overall at the 7 years of the Roberts Court, Roberts is usually with Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, and these are as conservative as any justices that there have been on the court since the mid-1930s. And when the court's ideologically divided, Kennedy is with them about 75% of the time. And so that's why I think it's a mistake to generalize from one or two cases in the last week of the term. You look overall at the 7 years of the Roberts Court, it's a very conservative court.
Could it be that the direction is changing a little because of the polls showing that the public has lost extraordinary amount of faith in the Supreme Court? I think at one point it was an 80% approval rating of the Supreme Court. Now it's something like 44%. Adam Winkler, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that any of the Supreme Court justices are looking at polls. Maybe some of that information has a subconscious effect on them. But nonetheless, I do think there's a broader historical judgment that justices, especially the Chief Justice, are going to be concerned with. They want to make sure that they have preserved the reputation of the court, the legitimacy of the court. You know, the court is one of the few institutions in Washington, D.C. left that have the reverence of we the people. And it's really taken quite a hit in recent years, perhaps as a result of long-term result of Bush versus Gore or some other cases. But we've seen that the court is losing some of the respect of the public. The approval rating is down to the mid-40s from something I saw recently. And I think Chief Justice Roberts was not concerned with the short-term effect of the health care decision, but concerned more with the long-term historical effect on the Supreme Court. The court, as we always say in constitutional law classes, doesn't have any ability to enforce its judgments. It doesn't have an army. It doesn't have the power of the purse, what the other two branches have. Instead, it has its legitimacy. It has the reasoning that it offers in opinions to try to win the respect of we the people. And only if the court has that respect will the court evade the charges of judicial activism that inhibit the court's ability to police the political process the way it should.
Larry Baum, I'd like to bring you back in. Give us a general sense of what you did in the puzzle of judicial behavior, which is to look at all of these various aspects, one being this concern for the legitimacy of the court that Adam Winkler is talking about, one being the kind of ideological push into a legal direction, redefining the Constitution. But there are other factors that you talk about as well, including how they impact each other. How do these things balance out in your research?
Well, one of the things I've learned is to be modest about trying to explain whether it's a single decision or the broader picture of what the Supreme Court does, because exactly as you say, I think there's a variety of different forces that operate on the justices, a variety of different considerations that help determine what direction they take, whether it's in the short run or the long run. It does seem to me, given the fact that in the great majority of Supreme Court cases, good legal arguments can be made on both sides, that the justices tend to follow what they regard as good policy. This is not entirely a conscious process, but again, given the ambiguity of the law, if we want to explain what the court does with a single factor, I think it's the justices' views about what's desirable public policy. Obviously, a lot of other things come into play, and I think that in cases as visible as the immigration case, as the healthcare case, where the justices have an opportunity, and it's unavoidable, that they think about the implications of what they do for their own reputation, for the position of the court, for policy in the long term, then the considerations that affect them become particularly complicated. You know, all the speculation that's taken place about the motivations of Chief Justice Roberts in casting the decisive vote in favor of the health care mandate, they've gotten a little silly in some respect. But in the aggregate, they're a reminder that there are a lot of different kinds of considerations that could have affected the Chief Justice's position.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, and we are talking about Supreme Court politics, judicial decision-making, and the effects of those decisions on society. Erwin, I'm coming back to you on this. It seems to me that as the Supreme Court cast their votes, that what they're doing is actually shaping a new America, because they're shaping the Constitution and the way elections can be done. And that tells us who's going to be elected and what policies are going to come through. How do you see the last few terms shaping the policies by shaping this Constitution and the rights that are coming out of it?
Let me start by perhaps disagreeing with the prior two comments. I don't believe that John Roberts' vote was at all about what would do the most to enhance the esteem of the court. I believe, and will continue to believe unless there's some evidence to the contrary, he voted to uphold the individual mandate because he believed as a matter of law it was a tax in the scope of Congress's taxing power. The fact that he might have changed his mind, I think, should make us admire him more that he's willing to be open-minded rather than thinking that something nefarious was going on. In terms of what the Supreme Court has done in the last few terms, I think the most important thing that the court has done, this is true of the overall Roberts Court, is how it's been closing access to the courts. But that's not an issue that resonates with most people. When the Supreme Court makes it harder for people who have been injured to sue in court or get released from the federal courts, that isn't something most people are aware of. I think that certainly what the Supreme Court does shapes the nature of policy and therefore the political system. The decision on the Affordable Care Act is a good example. But in the end, I think what this election is going to be about much more than anything else is perceptions of the economy and perceptions of leadership. And that's not something that's determined by the Supreme Court.
What about the elections, though? We are seeing considerable decisions coming down that are shaping elections, which then shape who gets elected.
Well, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission is enormously important in terms of the political system and who will get elected. And there was a decision 2 weeks ago in a case called Knox versus SEIU, which will really lessen the influence of public employee unions in elections. So what you've had the Supreme Court do over the last few years is simultaneously increase the influence of corporations in the political system and decrease the influence of unions in the political system. And that will have long-term consequences that we'll begin to see those consequences, I think, in this November's election.
Lawrence Baum?
Well, the Supreme Court's impact is often exaggerated because when the court reaches decisions on major issues, often what Congress does, what the president does, what people at the state and local level do, reshapes the policy to determine what actually will happen. Some of the court's major decisions have had very fundamental effects, and Citizens United, I think, is an example of that. But others have not been nearly as consequential as they have seemed to be because of the actions that have been taken afterwards. It may turn out that the decision on the health care law will be very consequential, but it might also be that the law is in fact essentially repealed, depending on the election results this fall. And so in the short run, it's often difficult to gauge how much difference decisions will make, and it's easy to exaggerate their effects because of the kinds of things that we don't anticipate happening when the decision itself is handed down.
Adam Winkler.
There's no doubt that the Roberts Court is interested in remaking American society in various ways. Most strong-willed justices are devoted to doing that in some way, shape, or form. But one of the ways in which the Roberts Court is really being effective, and to which there aren't really readily available alternatives for the legislature, is the Roberts Court reordering of the electoral process. We've seen a long-standing and aggressive plan to reconfigure American elections in a decidedly libertarian, deregulatory way. You mentioned Citizens United, the 2010 decision overturning the long-standing practice of limiting corporate influence on elections. The court had a case this term out of Montana that was a direct challenge to Citizens United, and the Montana Supreme Court had issued a surprising decision that basically said Citizens United didn't apply in Montana. And the Supreme Court threw it out despite the public outcry about Citizens United. The justices really aren't about to change their minds on that, and there's really very little that reformers can do to respond to Citizens United because it's an interpretation of the Constitution. And the court has also used the First Amendment of the Constitution to strike down many other campaign finance restrictions, including a decision critically wounding public financing. As Professor Chemerinsky mentioned already, the Knox case this year sort of rewrote the rules on union political activity and said that it's a complicated case, but basically rewrote the rules for 50 years in a way that would protect dissenting union members or non-members who have to support a union because they get the collective bargaining benefits. But the court has not said the same thing for, say, dissenting corporate shareholders who, under Citizens United, have to finance political speech that they don't support. So, and we see key case coming out the term next year where the court may invalidate a key provision of the Voting Rights Act that provides for federal oversight of electoral changes in states that have a history of discrimination. The court looks poised to strike that down. So we're really seeing the Roberts Court trying to remake the rules of American politics.
Finally, I think what I'd like to end with is that, as a whole, people have said that judges and justices have drifted ideologically toward the left over the course of their careers. Does that seem to still be the case? And do we see that occurring at all today? Erwin Chemerinsky?
I disagree with the premise. Antonin Scalia has certainly not drifted to the left since he came onto the court in 1986. Clarence Thomas hasn't drifted to the left since he came onto the court in 1991. Samuel Alito hasn't drifted to the left since he came onto the court in 2006. The reality is that most justices don't have major ideological transformations once they're on the court. Felix Frankfurter came onto the court as a liberal and left as the most conservative justice. Harry Blackmun came as a conservative and became a very liberal justice. I think John Paul Stevens drifted somewhat to the left, but we've got to remember the court changed around him. When he came on the court, you had Brennan and Marshall. When he left, he was the most liberal or among the most liberal of the justices. So I don't think that over time most justices drift to the left. I only wish it were the case that Scalia and Thomas and Alito, for that matter, Roberts, would start drifting to the left.
Lawrence Baum, this would be something that you may have noticed in your work.
Well, yes. There was a long string of appointments by Republican presidents to the Supreme Court between 1969 and 1991 without any Democratic appointments in that time at all. The results were not very satisfying to a lot of conservatives because the court remained considerably more moderate than they would have preferred. And for that reason, there was a lot of attention focused on some of the Republican appointments, either because the justices seemed to move at least a little to the left over time or because they were never as conservative as conservatives would have hoped. I think what has happened, though, is that the kinds of people that Republican presidents have chosen more recently, and this is certainly true of Justice Thomas, of Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito, are people who have such strong conservative records and strongly held conservative beliefs that if there was some pattern of drift to the left, and there's some evidence that there was, that's simply not happening anymore. And that's another reflection of the growing polarization of American politics. Republican activists simply will not allow a Republican president to select somebody to the Supreme Court who is not very strongly conservative. And so if there were was drift, if there were disappointments for Republican presidents, in this generation of judges, that's simply not happening anymore.
Adam Winkler, you get the last word.
Well, justices do sometimes drift to the left. There's an old saying that it's the greenhouse effect, which is named after the longtime New York Times Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse. And it was said that some justices tried to appeal to the Linda Greenhouse and the New York Times readership by moving to the left. But it's only because it's been so aptly named that we even think about it, because there's plenty of justices who've moved towards the right. Professor Chemerinsky mentioned some. Byron White was a Democratic appointee who turned out to be very conservative on the court. Justice Hugo Black, one of the great civil libertarians, by the time he left the court, had seemed to turn drastically to the right on many issues. So you can never tell, but I think it's a good thing when justices move their positions at least a little bit in this sense. I think that, like anything in life, spending 20 years as a Supreme Court justice should teach you something, and you should learn, and you should get a better understanding of the issues that you face and the complications and consequences of the decisions that you make. And so justices who evolve one direction or another, that's probably a sign of being open-minded and learning from your experience. But that's what we should hope for in judges.
What a perfect place to end. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. Erwin Chemerinsky with us, Dean and Professor of Law at University of California, Irvine, author of numerous books, including The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. Adam Winkler, Professor of Constitutional Law at University of California, Los Angeles, and author of Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms. Lawrence Baum, Professor of Political Science at Ohio State University, and author of Puzzle of Judicial Behavior and Judges and Their Audiences, and Specializing the Courts. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim, Carson Dezuris, and Aram Sasunian, who all contributed today's show. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.